Good morning. May it please the Court. Suzanne Lachelier on behalf of Appellant Ms. Nelly Herrera. In the sentencing proceeding in this case, the Court determined that methamphetamine manufacturing did occur in this case. The Court then...
It was big time.
Well, our position would be, Your Honor, that pseudoephedrine possession was perhaps arguably substantial, and that's the point of this issue regarding the application of the guidelines that the Court exercised, and that is that the District Court went from the listed chemical table under 2D1.11 to 2D1.1, which addresses specifically methamphetamine manufacture.
But that's what she was convicted of, correct?
She was convicted of
aiding and abetting conspiracy,
possession of pseudoephedrine with the.
I thought she was convicted of aiding and abetting.
That's right, sir.
The distribution of methamphetamine or the manufacture of methamphetamine. Isn't that what she was convicted of?
Conspiracy to possess pseudoephedrine, knowing it would be used to make methamphetamine, aiding and abetting.
What
the
was
same.
The charge? That's precisely. Right. The charge was under the methamphetamine statute, wasn't it?
It was under 21 U.S.C. 841A, which is the controlled substance statute, yes, Your Honor. It was also under 841D or C. D has become C, I should say. The actual indictment references 841C, and 841C is a listed chemical provision. And our position is that this listed chemical provision is the one that cross-references, or sorry, in appendix of the guidelines, references 2D1.11. And that the applicable guideline should have been 2D1.11.
But if she was found guilty of the count of 41A1, if she was found guilty of that conspiracy, then isn't she under that guideline?
Our position is that the way the government charged this, it was a conspiracy to possess pseudoephedrine in order to then assist in the manufacture of methamphetamine. So the core offense was truly possession of pseudoephedrine with the knowledge that down the line it would be used to manufacture meth. So the applicable guideline at its core and what the impetus really for the indictment is this possession of pseudoephedrine and not the down the road, if you will, 841A provision involving the manufacture of meth. And in fact, the evidence
that was charged, though, right?
It was charged in conjunction with this possession of pseudoephedrine.
But
yes,
the 841A crime was charged, correct?
Yes.
She just wasn't simply charged with the possession of pseudoephedrine.
It was a conspiracy to possess pseudoephedrine with the knowledge that down the line it would become methamphetamine, yes, sir.
Aiding and abetting the manufacturers of methamphetamine, is that right? Is that what you're charged with?
Unless I'm misremembering the indictment, my understanding was it was aiding and abetting this conspiracy to possess pseudoephedrine, not aiding and abetting Yes, I guess ultimately it can be read that it was aiding and abetting down the road, but I guess the point is that the indictment, really the allegations, the indictment center around this possession of pseudoephedrine, and that the long term outcome was methamphetamine manufacture.
But the charge was simply conspiracy to aid and abet the manufacture of methamphetamine, right? And you can do that without even having any methamphetamine if you conspire to do something to manufacture an illegal drug, right?
That's right, sir.
So it does make a difference whether they had the completed drug or not.
That's correct, sir. That's correct. And so if the court's reading, the district court's reading of the conviction and the guideline, the application of the guidelines in this context, must refer to 2D1.1, then there is no purpose in having a listed chemical provision under 2D1.11. There's virtually no purpose in having it because in every instance, someone in possession of a listed chemical.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of times, aren't there, where the government can charge you with, when you commit a certain offense, you run afoul of Statute A and you run afoul of Statute B. Government can charge you with either one of them. And if you're convicted, see, it sounds a lot like your argument is really with the conviction. Like, how can she be convicted of aiding and abetting a methamphetamine manufacturer when all she really was doing was selling pseudoephedrine, and maybe to middlemen. I'm not sure she was selling directly to the manufacturers, at least from what I've read. But anyway, all she's really doing is selling out. How could she be charged with aiding and abetting methamphetamine manufacturer? Well, she was.
Right, sir, but in the context of sentencing, I think what the court should have focused on, and obviously the court's correct in its analysis in terms of the conviction aspect, but in terms of the sentencing, I guess what the court should be looking at is what the substance of the conduct actually was. The fact that there was some knowledge of methamphetamine manufacture, arguably some knowledge of methamphetamine manufacture down the road, doesn't change that the core of the offense was an 841D, if I may refer to it just by the statute section, a possession of a listed chemical. And that is the quantities of the listed chemical that were addressed in the trial were what was used to try to show that it had to be methamphetamine manufacturer.
But that's a different animal, isn't it? I mean, the thing is, sure, you're right. If the mere fact, I can argue, and I think you can argue very persuasively, the mere fact that I'm selling large quantities of pseudoephedrine, obviously I know, I'm not going to be charged in the first place unless I'm doing it for the wrong reasons, but so obviously I know it's going to be used for the wrong reasons, and that mere fact alone could get me charged with that. It doesn't mean that I'm participating necessarily in a methamphetamine conspiracy, but that's what was charged here, and it seems to me that what you're attacking is that. She was charged with that. She was found guilty of that. And the guidelines, don't they say we enter the guideline book with the crime you were convicted of? And she was convicted of that crime, wasn't she?
She was convicted of that crime. Again, and I guess the purpose of the 841D is lost if always. I understand the court's position, obviously, but the purpose of 841D and the possession of a listed chemical with knowledge, I mean, that is the element of 841D, is possession of a listed chemical with knowledge that it would be used or reasonable cause to believe that it would be used down the road for methamphetamine manufacture. That's the core of that offense, and that's the guideline therefore encompasses this element of knowledge. And I guess my issue is really with the facts as they apply in sentencing. In the sense that the elements of 841D encompass this knowledge that methamphetamine is going to be manufactured. And 841D, the guideline provision applicable to that is 2D1.11, the listed chemical provision. If our position or the district court's position is always, well, anytime there's knowledge that down the road the drug is going to be used for methamphetamine manufacture, you cross-reference to drug manufacture, then there is no purpose in even charging that.
Let's put it this way. If they had come in and the indictment filed was simply that she aided and abetted she was in a conspiracy to aid and abet the manufacture of methamphetamine under Section 841, okay?
Right.
That's all they charged. That's what they charged. They didn't charge anything about pseudoephedrine. They simply said, aid and abet the manufacture of methamphetamine. And that's what she's convicted of. Let's say that's what happened.
Right, sir.
Where should the court go then when it gets to sentencing, in your view?
I see where the court's going. Obviously, in that context, the only provision the person would have been convicted as is A41A, and so the guidelines would reference 2D1.1. I understand.
That's the problem. She was convicted under that.
But the concern is that 841, then why?
You're absolutely right. That's why I'm trying to phrase it. That's how they did it on the indictment. I say, suppose that's all they indicted her for.
Right.
There you are. The problem is that unless you attack the indictment or won your case in front of a jury on the basis that, well, she wasn't really involved in 841A, unless you won on that particular indictment, there she'd be. And the government could have charged her under the other, but didn't charge her under this one instead. See, that's what I'm trying to...
And I think the danger there is that then the government can shop for its favorite guideline. And I suppose, arguably, the court's correct that on some level our challenge and is in some sense to the fact that the evidence of actual methamphetamine manufacture, and as noted in the briefs, the evidence of actual methamphetamine manufacture was de minimis. If it was, there was none, effectively, in the sense that, and I understand the jury's findings, obviously, but the evidence was merely that based on the quantity, there was enough quantity of meth, of pseudoephedrine, to show that they were aware, and that one of the co-conspirators knew that the substance was distributed down the line also to in order to manufacture methamphetamine.
Well, even there's something like at some point she says something like, gee, maybe we should get into doing this ourselves directly. I think there's some evidence of that.
Right. So, I mean, there's arguably evidence of the knowledge element, but certainly no evidence of that substantial step that the case law refers to about the manufacturing. And so, I mean, the court's correct, I guess, that on some level the issue is that the sufficiency of the evidence on that question of methamphetamine manufacture, and I recognize the jury's findings. The concern is that at sentencing, then, the government can shop with de minimis evidence, can shop for its favorite guideline, namely, it's always going to fall under 841A. And the purpose of the other provision, 2D1.11, is lost.
Were you trial counsel?
No, sir.
Did trial counsel try to get the court to put a specific findings by the jury as to whether they found the defendant guilty on part one or part two or both under the conspiracy?
No, sir, not that I recall from the record. The only special verdict finding was as to the amount in order to trigger. This was pre-Booker finding, so they made a special finding as to the amount.
Of course, if that had been requested and found out, then we'd know whether the jury would have found your client guilty under the subpart one or two or both.
Right? That's correct. It's unclear what the jury relied on and what the jury actually found, which part it was finding guilty. I mean, which part of the evidence it was relying on to find Ms. Herrera guilty of what.
Prior counsel went to a lot of detail on instructions but didn't say anything about that, which could have a big effect on the sentence here. Right.
That's right, sir. And so because of the vagueness, I think it was incumbent on the court to clarify that at sentencing. Because of the vagueness in the findings, it was incumbent on the court, and the court really made no findings. It merely adopted the PSR and then took this case from a listed chemical case to a controlled substance possession case.
Well, the court didn't really take it. If the court just entered the guidelines with that conviction, that's where it goes.
Well, it didn't actually, I understand, and you're right, but that's actually not what the court did on the record. The court actually adopted the PSR, and the PSR did apply that cross-reference, and I think that's where Ms. Herrera's concern arises, is that, in fact, the PSR made findings that this was a possession of pseudoephedrine case that involved the manufacturing of meth, and therefore the cross-reference should apply. And so this question of what involving the manufacturing of meth arises then, because that is what the court did, is adopt the PSR, and the PSR applied this cross-reference. So the court failed to explain how there were completed actions in this case sufficient to show that methamphetamine manufacturing occurred. I guess maybe the distinction is that under the guidelines, what's necessary to show to link the methamphetamine and require allow this cross-reference is actually not necessarily a greater level of proof, but the language is stronger in terms of what they want, what is necessary to apply the cross-reference. Meaning, and I apologize, I'm wandering here. The guidelines.
No, this is a very exciting discussion.
Sorry, Your Honor. The guidelines,
but
sorry.
Don't you have any other issues?
Yes, I can move on. The other concern that Ms. Herrera raised in this case is that the district court accepted wholesale the admission of a number of business records, or supposedly business records, without engaging in any of the proper findings necessary to determine if these documents were appropriate for the business record exception. Ms. Herrera's counsel below made a specific objection as to the reliability of these records. The lack of trustworthiness of the records is a determination that the district court is required to make under the business record exception.
Some of the problems with the records is that your client had signed off on them, and they were her orders, weren't they?
Some of them. That's correct, and we would argue that that in itself is a problem, because part of the business record exception is to rule that is to determine if the records were made by the business. And although a business can hold records from another individual that were created by another individual, the case law suggests in Arteaga, which we cited in our briefs, indicates that at the very least, if the record is made by another, it has to be verified by an employee of the business in order to be admissible as a business record. And there was no evidence.
Don't we have authority to say that business records in the form of customers asking, send me $50 worth of X pills, that sort of thing? I thought we had things to say that business keeps those in the ordinary course of business. Those become business records. Obviously, they're not prepared by the business, but they're received by the business and they ship on that. And that's a business record. Know what we're talking about?
Well,
she sends in a thing that she's actually signed, which looks not like an admission. But anyway, she sends in a thing that she's actually signed, she sends it in, at least, to this business. The business gets it, puts it in its business records, ships out 50 kilos of X.
And a dovetail.
I'm not sure that the evidence was that clear as to. I mean, the government did show that some of the documents perhaps dovetailed. I'm not sure it was clear that the ones that she produced dovetailed with a shipment out, and I may be misremembering the record. I'm not sure the dovetailing was done explicitly on the record, I guess is my point. But also, in addition to that, the certification doesn't clarify that the business adopted those records. It merely shows that the business had those records in its files. The certification parrots the 8036 parameters for what a business record is, but it doesn't actually say this is how we use these records.
Is there any doubt that those records that came from your client are authentic?
Not on the record below, no, sir. There's no specific.
Maybe it's an admission against interest.
As to the records that my client created, there still remains the concern, because obviously quantity is an issue, was an issue on the merits and at sentencing. It still goes to the scope of how many of these documents actually were admissible and fell under the business record exception as opposed to admission against interest. So even if the court wants to take that the records from my client were admissions against interest, there was still a slew of records showing quantities of pseudoephedrin sales that were not adopted in the sense of shown. The certification at the very least should have explained how the business used these records rather than merely parroting 8036 and saying these records were kept in the regular conduct of business activity, et cetera, et cetera. There should be some actual application of how that was done in that business. And Ms. Herrera's objection below was quite explicit in saying this business was suspicious. This business is no longer in practice. This business was engaging in large quantities of pseudoephedrine distribution that were suspicious to the DEA themselves. And the district court had an obligation at that point when realizing the undercurrent behind this pseudoephedrine distributor to inquire into the trustworthiness of the records. That is still a prong under 8036, and the district court failed to do that.
You want to save some time?
Yes, if I may, I'll reserve the balance of my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Tracy Wilkinson on behalf of the United States. I was trial counsel. I indicted the case, and I was trial counsel. So I can tell the Court I just wanted to speak momentarily with respect to the sentencing issue to clarify two points of the record. One is that the Court is correct. The defendant was charged with conspiracy to do two objects. The first object was to aid and abet the manufacture of methamphetamine under 841A1. The second object was possessing pseudoephedrine, knowing or having reasonable cause to believe that it would be used to manufacture methamphetamine under 841C2. There was a special verdict form that went to both objects. There was a special verdict form. It was actually pretty detailed as to both defendants. It set out for the jury to make a specific finding as to each independent object, and I remember that specifically because the 841A1 object carries a 10-year mandatory minimum. So we necessarily had to specify that as a special verdict, and they found that object in particular. They found both objects. So on the sentencing issue, I would agree with the court that she was found guilty of the 841A1 and the sentencing guideline 2D1.1 applies.
When the jury made this finding on the objects, did it make finding that the defendant was guilty on that one and two paragraphs?
Yes. Okay. It was
both of them.
It was set out separately so that there was, you know, do you, with respect to count one, do you find him guilty of the first object being conspiracy to aid and abet the manufacture of methamphetamine, yes or no? And then under that was a question of the quantity that mirrored the mandatory minimum quantities in the statute. And then there was another question about the second object, the pseudoephedrine object.
Okay.
With respect to the business records issue raised by the defense, I would submit that the court's admission of the business records at issue were neither plain error nor, for that matter, an abuse of discretion, because both rules 803.6 and 902.11 were adhered to, and because the evidence was cumulative to either clearly admissible or non-objectionable evidence.
I believe there was an assertion that we didn't have jurisdiction over that issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I will submit on that issue unless this court has any questions.
Well, it looks to me like that may not be correct, and so I do have a question. The notice of appeal form, really none of the boxes are checked, except what looks to me like a statistical box that we always want to know is how long was the sentence, but no other box is checked, period. So is your position that no issues properly before the court, or that all issues are properly before the court, or we pick and choose?
My position is that based on that notice of appeal, only the sentencing issues were selected for appeal. Based on that, on the indication regarding sentencing,
well, the notice of appeal has a number of boxes. The first is I'm appealing my conviction only, not checked. I'm appealing my conviction and sentence, not checked. I'm appealing my sentence only, not checked. This is a 32C5 appeal, not checked. Interlocutory appeal, not checked. None of those bases for appeal are checked. The only thing that's checked is, he says, what was the sentence imposed, basically? And he says 360 months. So, is it at least ambiguous? Since sentence only wasn't checked, but sentence imposed was,
I think it certainly is ambiguous. I think that when looking at that notice of appeal and seeing that the sentencing is indicated, and then in combined with the fact that only the sentencing transcript was ordered at that time, and then all the continuance requests after that were only based on the sentencing, I think a fair inference was that only the sentencing was meant to be appealed.
But if it's ambiguous, school's out, right? Because if it's ambiguous, then we go ahead and say, well, you guys all briefed it, and that's the end of it.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I mean, I think that's why the government moved to dismiss those allegations prior to filing their substantive response, because I think you're right. I think under Shin, once we filed our substantive response, there's an argument that there hasn't been any prejudice, although I was up late working on it, so I don't know if that counts as prejudice.
Okay.
I spoke to the business records, and I believe, like I said, that it was neither plain error nor an abuse of discretion, because I think that both rules 803.6 and 902.11 were adhered to, and because, like I said, the evidence was cumulative to either properly admitted or non-objected to evidence. With respect to the discovery motion, I would argue to the court that
is that for us now? You're here on rebuttal, right? Two issues were raised.
Fair enough, Your Honor. I will also clarify that the government does agree that an amyline remand is appropriate, and I don't think I need to speak further to that. If there are no other questions, then I will submit.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Very briefly, just to address this issue of the notice of appeal, since the government did discuss it, I would only state that it's no different. The notice of appeal that was filed is no different than someone having filed a motion that they wrote themselves saying they're appealing from the judgment. If, in fact, we penalize an individual who uses the standard form because they don't check the proper boxes, then we're actually penalizing individuals who are using the proper form versus someone who files their own motion and says, I appeal from the judgment. I think the intent behind Rule 3...
Well, I think that's not going to happen, so...
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. And I would only very briefly address the issue of the discovery.
Well, you can't do that, no.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were leaning the other way, Your Honor. I understand.
Yeah.
Then I have no further argument. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Matter will stand submitted. And next matter is United States versus Reeder. Oh, that's submitted. Okay. Well, I guess that's it. We're going to recess and then reconstitute the panel at 10:30. We're back at 10:30.